227, our nonprofit gallery operated and owned by our charming and humble friend to all artists, Adrian Rivas, who's working our camera right now, showing off his sexy legs. Adrian and I met last fall, and he heard about my thesis, which is the first to begin documenting the East LA DJ experience. I've interviewed several DJs sitting here. Thank you. The thesis is now available. We met after the holidays at the beginning of the year and began to conceptualize how we could bring this history and art to life. Tonight is one of our dreams come true. Steve Beltran, who is in the book, came to one of the previous panels and offered to organize tonight's panel. The discussions that we've been having revolve around the concept of exploring and archiving DJ culture from East LA. The panels are designed to capture testimonies from leaders of the DJ movement from the present, the past, and the future, so their history can be included in the future discussions of the West Coast and global dancing and Chicano cultural production. So welcome everybody to the fourth East LA DJ panel, Mixmasters, Residents, and Friends. This is our time. Our slice of cultural history needs to be told by everyone in it. This show is just a drop in the bucket of the histories that everybody here probably has regarding their participation, their view of what happened throughout the years from the 70s all the way up to the 2000s. If you look back at our history as Raza in Southern California, for example, lowrider culture, we've been lowriding since the Pachuco days, since the 40s. But it wasn't until the 70s that Lowrider Magazine came out and people started reading about it and writing about it, and it spread all over the world. Well, it's 30 years since we've been DJing, and finally we're here within ourselves telling the stories without letting others tell the stories for us. This DJ culture thing is already around the world, and it already is being written about and talked about, but our story needs to be included in that, and that's what we hope to get from these discussions and panels and publications and things that are coming out, such as the KCET web story that just launched this week on kcet.org. We have a computer up there set up for you to view the various aspects of that, the looking at backyard parties. Also, the text that I've written is also available on Lulu for you to pick up. Support a starving artist, teacher. We don't get paid much. And the DJs on this panel have been spinning since the late 70s and early 80s. Some of them are from the most influential DJ booths in the area, from Beverly Hills to Montebello to La Puente. They have had their hands in music production, promotion, sales, and publication throughout their careers. They have seen the scene go through its various changes and work within it always. The gathering of these DJs, again, would not be possible if not for the work of Steve Beltran. This will truly be an intimate conversation among DJs who have known each other throughout the years. One last thing, please get on our email list so you know what's coming up, because we have some pretty amazing events that they're constantly popping up. So let me introduce to you. Yeah, he'll set you up on the right into the computer. And I'm sorry, I don't have many copies of the book today, but we are set up for you to just order it online. And there's flyers out there to if you want to do it later. Steve Beltran, who's going to be moderating this panel, as soon as I shut up, he'll take it over, started DJing in 1978 as the mobile DJ Risqué. He quickly moved into DJing with the Teddy Boys at the Casa Camino Real and was the founding DJ and resident DJ at Florentine Gardens. He has spun at several Rock of the 80s parties. He's also spun at the various Fantasias in downtown, the Valley, and Puente Hills, also at Quiet Canyon, and was there for the remodeling of it as it is now 2020, but you know, we all still call it Quiet Canyon. He's also spun at the Palace, the Century Club, Atlantis in Orange County, and Asia 101. As a producer, he's most popular for Walk Like an Egyptian from 1985, Casanova, Hazy Shade of Winter, and Hearsay in 1987. Hearsay became a number one hit in Europe, and 1988's Mercedes Boy. He has worked with Jesse Johnson, Paula Abdul, and Prince. This guy is a true tech guy, a geek, a gentleman, and a badass DJ, Steve Beltran.
All right, how's everybody doing? We're going to be talking about spinning in the early 70s. And of course, I brought my very close personal friends who have been spinning much longer than I have. And they were the ones that I listened to develop my style of mixing records. I know that you know, growing up in East L.A., my older brothers and sisters would listen to, you know, Tower of Power and the Average White Band, Ralphie Pagan, and, you know, I would listen to this music and, you know, think that there was something more, and I would start listening to disco records on the radio. So my first question is, you know, what music in the past, you know, was it that influenced you guys to play, to become a DJ and develop your style? Carlos.
Well, before I started DJing, I was going to salsa clubs. And I really liked it because of the percussion and the dancing. So when back in 78, they were doing Disco Hustle. I don't know if you guys remember. But it was similar to salsa, and it was an easy transition. And then I started going to disco clubs. And I don't know if you guys remember Osco, where they filmed Thank God It's Friday. There was a DJ.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to step in, but Carlos is a DJ. He played all the clubs in Beverly Hills. He did Tramps. He did World. He did, tell me what else.
Max 151.
Max 151. And also is a former Billboard reporting DJ, which was very, very exclusive. They were the ones that compiled the, you know, Billboard magazine top 50 dance tunes. And he was one of, like, you know, 25 or 30 DJs across the country that compiled that. So, you know, what he was playing in his rooms was really, really, you know, something that was important to what was going to be put in this magazine as the top 50 records that were being played across the country. Also, you know, back then, you know, the DJs, what they were doing in the clubs was, you know, what the radio listened to add songs, as opposed to now, you know, you know how much money you're paying the radio station, it determines whether or not your record's going to get on the air. But I'm sorry to interrupt, but go ahead and continue with what you were doing.
So
just a little bit of history about Carlos.
Thank you. So anyway, I was going to Osco's, where they filmed Thank God It's Friday, and I noticed the DJ. I had no idea what the hell he was doing, but I knew I liked it. His name was Mario Gonzalez, and without him knowing, he influenced me to become a DJ. Then I started going to Circus and listening to Mike Lewis before Martin Rodriguez started playing there, who's absent here today. And that's how I got started. I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just started doing it, and ran into some luck and got some good clubs to play at, a lot of celebrity clubs, and kept going from there. And about it. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, sure you did. But, I mean, what that's more of like your style of mixing. What was it that you know, inspired you? You know, was it just going to hear these guys? And
actually, just looking at Mario doing what he was doing inspired me to play.
There you go. There you go. Peeble, can you give us... All right. Peeble here.
All right. Wait, I'm going to say... Okay, go ahead.
This is my... You know, one of my mentors, man. I used to listen to this guy play, and, you know, his mixing styles and skills are out of this world. Fantasia, QC's, Pantera Rosa, which was, you know, one of three or four maybe straight clubs at the time, because disco was all gay clubs. back in the day. I mean, you had to go to, you know, gay clubs to hear this music, and there was only a handful of them that were straight, and Pantera Rosa was right across the street from QC's, or Quiet Canyon, right on Garfield, right on the corner there, and him and Henry Valdez were the DJs there. You know, when I turned 21, that's my first place that I went to, and, you know, prior to that, I had to sneak in places like the Disco 500. I just was talking earlier about it, and I would hear the DJ there, and you know, these guys were, you know, they were making records sound, even though they were changing it, it was making it sound like it was one continuous record, and I enjoyed that. That's what inspired me, along with Peebo's skills. So, Peebo,
what was the question?
What was it that influenced you, you know, your style of mixing records?
Well, I started in 1978 in San Juan, Puerto Rico, at a place called Leonardo's. And I spun there for a year. And back then, disco music was really popular in Puerto Rico. I used to go before I went there to live, I used to go every other year just to go to the discotheques. And I was a disco dancer in L.A., and I used to go to Destiny 2, right, Carlos?
Yeah.
And there was a guy named
Ron Green,
and he started mixing. He was playing Dance, Dance, Dance by Chic. You know, it goes dance, dance, dance. Then he was answering it with Let's All Chant. So it was going dance, 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 and then the claps were coming in. Clap, 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 clap. So, and I'm dancing, right? I'm going, what is he doing? But it was so perfect. So then after that, I went up there and I started to watch him. And then I thought, you know, I could do that. And so that's what influenced me.
Well, you know, I used to go to the backyard parties, and it was like face-to-face, mobile jocks. And, you know, this was like the disco scene. I couldn't get into clubs. You know, I'd hear John Guzman play and Mario Vindy Champagne. And, you know, I thought that was cool in the way they put it together, but I wanted to see, you know, how other stuff was done. You know, some of the stuff you would see in Billboard's charts, you know, was not being played in the backyard clubs. That backyard clubs were really, really loud, heavy disco, and trying to, and I wish Marty was here too, so I can, you know, see his sound. But the disco stuff was you know, the circus disco. And, you know, you'd see the charts, and that stuff wasn't being played there. So I started going to all ages clubs, like Marilyn's in Pasadena, and also my uncle's in the Valley. And I would hear Boris Granich play. And like I said, at this time, I was still, you know, getting inspired. I played music in high school, and, you know, I got a concussion playing football, broke my thumb playing baseball, and broke my nose playing basketball, and you know, music was looking really good at that point. So, I started researching myself and hearing DJs play, and since I played drums, I would hear, you know, Boris Granich playing at Maryland's. And, you know, we all are hardworking DJs here, you know, and I don't criticize people. But, you know, I thought about what he was doing and seeing what he was doing, and it was, you know, slightly offbeat and slightly out of key. You know, I thought that, like, you know, well, what if somebody, you know, took all of your records that were 120 BPM and at this cut in this harmonic key, you know, what if you took them all together and did that and tried to make one big long thing, and, you know, spent, you know, all summer long doing a go nowhere job to get dough to buy myself my first turntables. And you know, from there, started going to Disco 500 and sneaking in there and just looking at DJs play, you know, I was trying to get my foot in the door, knocking, you know, trying to, hey, you know, are you guys looking for a DJ here? Or, you know, what have you, like that, right? So during that time, guys, you know, what else was available, you know, for DJs to do aside, you know, from being a club jock? You know, now you got guys, you know, their own mix shows, and, you know, like our good buddy Raul Campos, you know, he's taken it a long way, and he's, you know, he's worked with me a lot, and you know, Martin Rodriguez a lot, and you know, a lot of avenues are open nowadays for DJs. You know, whether you're working video or you're on the radio mix show, was any of that stuff available to any of you guys, you know, during that early era?
Well, yeah, I think back in the early 80s, Henry Valdez, who didn't make it tonight, and I opened up a record store called Record Galaxy in Montebello. And we tried to bring in all the latest dance records from Europe and stuff to try to feed the DJs that were on the east side, because otherwise you'd have to go all the way to the west side to the record stores to get stores. And so we did that in like 19...
Well, you know, like prior to that, there was only like one store.
Yeah, there was one store.
One store to go buy records.
Record Depot back out in Hollywood.
And Ron's Records.
And Ron's Records, which was the second one. And then what was really cool about that was that Henry was buying imports from Canada. And I would have to say that our store brought in Your Love by Lime. I know we were the very first store, and I think that Carlos was the very first DJ to play Your Love in a club,
if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember, but I
guess. Well, I'll remember for him. Because we only got in two copies, and Henry took one and you took the other. But so back in the early 80s, it was really tough for a Latin DJ to really get established because, and this is not a disparaging comment, but a lot of the disco that was going on was run by there was a record pool called the LA DJ Association. Southern California Disco DJ Association. In Hollywood. And it wasn't, there weren't hardly maybe one or two Latinos in there. Mario Gonzalez, because he was a Billboard reporter. And so it was really tough for us to get records. So what we would have to do just to get records was to go out every Friday, Carlos and I and Henry, and I don't know if you ever went with us, but we used to go to all the record companies in Hollywood.
Marty used to go too.
And Martin. And we used to go and we practically had to beg to get records. And they looked at us like, well, who are you guys? Well, I spin at La Pantera Rosa. Well, what's that, you know? So, but our persistence paid off. And eventually we were able to join the Southern California Disco DJ Association and start to make a name for ourselves. But back then, even back then, in the early 80s, there weren't any mix shows. When I would go back to New York to the DJ convention, they had mix shows there in Miami, but you come back here and Power 106 wasn't established. And even if they were, they didn't have mix shows yet. It was like the West Coast, the DJ evolution was slow to evolve compared to New York or Europe, even Puerto Rico. And so there weren't a lot of things available to us until Power 106 came on the scene. And then at that time, a lot of DJs were starting to develop producer skills, like Martin, you know, and we formed Stop, and we had that hit Wake Up. And then Sabby Reyes started to produce records, and he started to get his name on the charts. So it was around 83 to 85 that things really started to take shape for us. But by this time on the East Coast, they were moving at lightning speeds beyond us.
You know, Carlos was a Billboard reporter, and you know, I got to tell you, you know, aside from being my friend and all of our friend the people that Peebo just mentioned, I mean, Carlos introduced us to a lot of people and made a lot of the labels start looking in our direction because, you know, where he lived, and Carlos would come to all of our places just to let, you know, inform you that I want him to now speak. So tell us your thing.
way back.
Yeah.
Well, after
you know,
I listened,
what Peebo was saying, you know what I mean?
About what's available.
What available? Yeah.
Well, there was a Q102, and they had like one little fucked up
That's
little
right.
mix show with Mario Flores. And so there wasn't too much available as far as radio. And I want to say one thing. I never looked towards radio because to speak, if a DJ talked in a club, that was taboo. So you were either going to be an announcer as a radio personality. A DJ radio guy was an announcer. He was a voice, you know, Columbia School of Broadcasting type of deal. But if you were a club jock, to speak on the microphone, unless you were saying last call, you sucked, okay? You're mixing the kind of said who you were. So instead of talking through a mix, you had to mix to say who you were. And to learn how to mix, I didn't know how to mix. I saw people mixing, and I could tell what was a good mix and a bad mix. And Mario, like I said, I would watch him, and Mike Lewis, who I thought was just flawless. He was a circus DJ. And there wasn't many clubs, you know, to hone your skills back then. I mean, I didn't have a setup at home. So I actually took jobs at gay clubs. So if any gay people out there recognize me, what's up? But I played at Woody's Hyperion. That's where I honed my skills. That's where I learned how to mix. And, you know, it takes practice. So that being said, I got other jobs. I also want to say this. I got offered a job at a call club, a club called Plato's Retreat. And I don't know if you saw this movie with Leguizamo. What was the name of that movie?
Summer of Sam.
Yeah, and they went to Plato's Retreat in New York. I actually played for Plato's Retreat here in Hollywood.
And it was people that don't know that, that's like a sex club.
Yeah, it was a clothing optional club. And it kind of scared the shit out of me. And then AIDS hit right there, and that shit was over. So I got a job at Max 151, and I already knew how to spin. And luckily, the owner of the club was the producer of the Gap Band. So every Gap Band record you hear was, I had a major influence in that record because I played them before they were even records. And I think I get mixing consultant credits on them, which didn't put any money in my pocket, but, you know, it further developed my career.
That was terrible.
So, you know, if you weren't gay and you know, that was the start of disco. I mean, I had to find a way to do it, and that's how I found my way, was playing in gay clubs. And then later on, it, you know, disco hit mainstream, and that opened up the doors for, you know, a lot more work.
You know, as an aside, you know, Carlos, he was like, he had his ear to the street. He was like kind of like a street cat. And like, Carlos was the one that hipped a lot of us DJs to scratching. Like, you know, we heard about scratching, and we knew about Rapper's Delight, but there was a club called Radio that opened up over near MacArthur Park, right?
Park Avenue.
It was, well, before it was Radiotron, it was just called Radio. And there was a DJ called The Glove.
Chris The Glove.
Chris The Glove. And so Carlos says, man, you got to see this guy.
And it was Ice-T, the rapper.
And Ice-T was rapping. And Egyptian Lover was programming beats live on an 808. So you have Egyptian Lover programming beats, The Glove scratching, and Ice-T rapping. And it wasn't like a Latino thing. It was like a like it was a mixed kind of like rock,
avant-garde
crowd, because everybody dressed real trippy. Well, anyway, Carlos was the one that discovered this place. And he says, hey, we got to go. So I would get off at 4 o'clock in the morning from Fantasia, and all the other DJs would go there after their gig. And then Carlos would take us down to this place, and we walked in, and I mean, you know, we were just mixing DJs, blending DJs. That was our thing, you know, tricks, a few little tricks. We walked in, and we walked out of there shaking after watching this guy, The Glove, rock the turntables with two of the same record, back and forth, scratching, mixing, flipping it around. Egyptian Lover's programming beats light on the 808, and then Ice-T's rapping. And it was like our first introduction to another, like a whole nother level of DJing. And that happened in like 82 or 82, 83 or something like that. And so I just think that that's kind of like an important part of the evolution of the LA DJ, because even Carlos and I even tried a few of those tricks. I mean, they're not easy. They're really not easy, but you know, you can like monkey around with a couple of records and do a little bit of scratching. And actually, I started to scratch a little bit,
I scratched.
Well, you know, I remember. You know, Tony Largo and myself. You know, we opened up Florentine Gardens, and I remember taking my mobile system, and there used to be a big empty. It was not empty. It was a hospital, like an emergency room. And you know, we would they got bought out, and we used to take my sound system in there and Pegasus mobile system in there, and we would how you guys mentioned Ice-T, he would show up there, because I mean this it was you know the 18 and over spot to be at. I mean, it was so huge. You know, we were doing 1,700 people on a Saturday night. Ice-T and Joe Cooley were working together, who actually went by the name of New York City Spin Master.
Oh, yeah.
And he would come, Ice-T would come in there and beg Tony and myself, let me talk, man. And we would go on and we'd let him do his thing. And, you know, Tony was the guy that would, you know, he was the superstar. And, you know, he did the gig. And, you know, I, you know, was always the understudy guy. And, you know, Tony would come in. And I remember the hot tunes were like Debbie Deb, Look Up. Because the freestyle stuff was just starting. And the 18 and over crowd liked it. The disco stuff, you know, we played it. But it wasn't a whole lot of it. Like, you know, circus or something, you know, where it was sole format of that room. We did a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, Tony would always come in, you know, he'd be counting money at the door and then come in when the room was jam-packed and play every hit record and then go like, hey, Humbug, go ahead, bro, take over, Humbug. You know, and I'd be like, all right, what am I going to do? So we started doing 80s K-Rock stuff. And those guys would come in there and just, they'd beg us to play. And we kind of like helped them out and let them do their thing. And, you know, they got their whole, his whole Warner deal, and their whole career took off from that. You know, there was places that I played at in the past where, you know, we would play a certain style, and I'm, you know, I'll say it, you know, low. It was like, you know, Newport Beach and the clubs over there where they didn't want us to play. And I remember the manager coming up, and, you know, we tried to play like hip-hop tunes. And the managers would come up and go like, no, we, you know, don't play that music there. You know what I mean? We don't, you know, angry black man music is not what we want in this room. You know, keep it up. And, you know, there's a room full of white people and college people. And, you know, they're here having dinner and buying drinks and, you know, make them dance. Just don't play that music. Did you guys ever have anybody, you know, at any places that you worked at that you know, would try to tell you music that you played, or were essentially you were the programmer and did what you felt was the correct thing to play for that room? Carlos?
I'm going to tell you a story. When I opened Wings, and the owner, one of the owners of Wings, I used to work as a bartender at one of the clubs I worked at in the Beverly Center. And he opened Wings, he brought me over there. And I brought Peebo and Henry Valdez, who's supposed to be here, but he's not. But Henry Valdez, we saw, you know, he saw right away it was going to be a Latin crowd. I guess he wanted, like, a real upwardly mobile crowd, or, you know, mixed, you know, not many Latinos. But as you all know, it was all Latinos at Wings. So Henry was playing Latin-oriented, you know, disco-like Capital Tropical and stuff, you know. And he didn't, Edmund didn't want Henry to play because he was playing all that Latin music, you know, or Spanish music, which later on, I mean, that's all it became, you know. So he got a bad rap for being, you know,
a Latin DJ.
For being, you know, for picking the right type of music.
Right.
Yeah.
I think all these, like, whenever they opened up, like, Wings or, like, Fantasia, we all went to all the, you know, the grand openings, and it, like, for Fantasia, where I spend most of my years, I was there for the grand opening, and they had a couple other DJs, and they were, like, kind of top 40 DJs, and I think all the owners wanted a diverse crowd. But, you know, you open up a club down on North Figueroa in the city of Los Angeles, and it eventually went, you know, puro Latino, or practically. And on Fridays, my start there was, because I had to work my way up, I had the happy hour from 5 to 9 on Fridays. Well, by 5:15, the line was around the block. But it was all the people that came from downtown L.A. And there were a lot of African-Americans. Remember that? And so the bummer was that we were, you know, was like, you know, they had hors d'oeuvres, and yeah, they drank, but when the regular crowd started to get there at 9 or 10 o'clock, the crowd was still there, because we rocked them, you know? So then the manager would come up to us and say, play rock and roll, play K-Rock. And so it was a bummer, because I really didn't like doing it, but, and we would play that stuff for 45 minutes to an empty floor, the club was packed, the dance floor was empty, and I'm playing this crazy rock and roll. And you know, and the brothers, they knew what was up, and they go, we know why you're playing that, but we'll, you know, you got our money, we're out of here. So that was, and then the only other time they made me play something was whenever the fire marshal walked in. Play Billie Jean. That was it. You played,
and
keep the aisles clear. Play Billie Jean, man. So out of, you know, you're playing like Love Is In You or something, you got to drop Billie Jean. It's like a bomb. But sure enough, everybody was, you know, just super packed the floor.
You know, unfortunately, my mentor, who I love as a DJ, Martin Rodriguez, you know, is not here, and he shafted me, and I'm so angry that he's not here. But, you know, I started working with him at Fantasia. You know, he was doing his thing there, and, you know, they wanted somebody, because Friday nights was packed from 4. They were open from 4 a.m. to 4 in the morning. It was a 12-hour shift. And, you know, Marty wanted to get done, and, I, you know, sometimes he would do the late shift, and whatever he didn't want, he would just throw me a bone and, you know, here, do this gig, or come in at this time. But, you know, it was, you know, essentially a tiny little place, like maybe, what was Fantasia, 200-300 people in there?
350 was legal.
Right. Well, I mean, he'd have the room packed with like
700 people.
Yeah, you know, 500 or 600, 700 people in there, and there was a line in, you know, the hotel going around with another 300 or 400 people in there, and he showed me that, you know, by what you were doing, you know, you could pack the floor, or he had total control. You didn't want to blow everybody out of the room. He wanted to sell some drinks, and he would throw a so-so record on. Some of the people would get off by drinks. Other people were on the floor. If they didn't like it, they left the room, and that would let some other people else some other people in from the line. And it was a never-ending
rotation
that he did. And, you know, he was the master at doing that. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to see that. You know, some of the early disco records were, you know, like all acoustic instruments. You know, you take some of the, you know, El Coco stuff.
Live drums.
You know, all live drums, live bass, live guitars. You know, in the early, like, 70, at least from what I remember, 78, you know, synthesizers got introduced to dance disco music. You know, I'm talking about, like, and this is just me. I know you guys probably have older ones, but, you know, Over and Over by Disco Circus. Mm. And, you know, and Pussyfoot Dancer Dance, you know, where they still had live bass going, but it was a sequence synth part that, you know, everybody, or else, here's another example, like Love Disco Style. You know, when it went to this electronic TB-303 synth part, everybody waited for that part to come up, and then they would go crazy. You know, how did the introduction of synthesizers influence what you guys, you know, your dance floor programming? How did you guys, you know, add that in there when people were essentially listening to, you know, and how did they accept the synthesizer being added to disco music?
I don't think the crowd knew the difference, whether the drummer was playing to a click track or whether it was a sequencer, right. A sequence drum.
I mean, as DJs. The reason why I asked
that. It made it easier for us.
Like you know, these songs had a part where the song would play and it would get to that part and everybody would go crazy. And then little by little, you started hearing, you know, that part, a crazy synthesizer part, but going through the whole record, like Giorgio Moroder or Donna Summer. I mean, and like Donna Summer, I Feel Love, totally, you know, flipped everything around. I mean, because it was an absolute hit record. Everybody went crazy, and it was very, very strong production going through the whole track for the whole you know, time that the song was being played. I mean, when that came out, did people still accept that, you know, John Davis and the Monster Orchestra, you know, or El Coco and stuff like that were still doing that? Or did they solely want to get into, you know, the Italiano sound? It was all synth, you know what I mean? Everything and that whole Cetico stuff. How did it get to that? You guys just stopped playing it and went totally synthesizer?
Well, we're talking about two different types of recording, that what Steve's referring to, and different kinds of disco records. And, you know, the early records were real live drummers and musicians. And so to play two records with two different drummers, matching up two different drummers for a long time was not easy. So in the early days, we had to think of creative ways of mixing, like a vocal coming out of a horn or matching a string with a string, and not a really long segue. But when the records that he's talking about came in, well, you can't just do that with those records because they have these long, long intros. So that's, I think, start to bring in a different style of mixing. And then you have to take into consideration, well, the dancers. Well, the dancers in the late 70s were still dancing the hustle. But now this music was a little bit more loose, and people were starting to separate a little bit. So I think you just had to mix it a little bit differently, mix it a little bit longer. But you couldn't play too many of these electronic records back to back to back because they didn't have as much soul as the other records. So you can see the people they're almost all instrumental, and they had vocoders and weird sounds.
When people were drunk and, you know, you start hearing this winding synthesizer thing, you're just going over and over and over, you know.
You're saying, what's that,
exactly,
you know?
So synthetic sounds, you know.
So they were kind of like a hit, but just a few of them took off, and you couldn't play them all night long, and you had to sandwich them in between a couple of hits. But they were exciting records, like the Donna Summer record and like Giorgio.
Well, I mean, to this day, I mean, that stuff is still, you know,
very prevalent,
very, very, very strong. And, you know, I mean, I love electronic dance music. And, I mean, even today you hear it, you know, influenced on, you know, Orbital records or the Chemical Brothers records. I mean, everything is arpeggiated bass lines.
Yeah. There was a guy called Patrick Cowley, a producer out of San Francisco, that came out with a whole album full of that stuff, and the DJs played almost every song on it. And then he really cracked the top 10 with Do You Want to Funk when he produced Sylvester. And I think that was like kind of like the peak of that stuff in like 84, 85, around there. But then he passed away, and there weren't a lot of other DJs or producers at the time producing that style of disco music.
For me, it just made it easier to mix, do more awesome mixes, overlays.
Everything was dead on, you know.
It was just a lot easier, a lot more fun for us, rather than sweating and mixing. Am I going to miss this mix? Am I going to sound like a horse track or something?
Stampede.
Or, you know. So it was just a lot easier. Intros, outros, breaks. It made it a lot easier. I don't think the crowd really noticed the difference, although it got a little monotonous.
As long as your mixes were on, they
just got a little monotonous because of the, you know, it's too repetitive. It doesn't have that real live feel.
Right. You know, since the whole digital thing has come about, I don't know if you guys use Serato or you've seen it, or, you know, people think that production and DJing has, you know, kind of lost its heart. That it's not there anymore. People aren't doing those nice, because I work in clubs now. I mean, I'm not a DJ there. You know, I see it's tattooed downtown here, and I run sound and lighting with my buddy John over there. But, you know, we see all these DJs come in, and they all, you know, just bring their laptop, plug it right in, and let's go. And, you know, you're hearing a verse, chorus, boom, next tune, and, it's put together fair at best. And, you know, it's just bam, 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 bam. You know, there's nothing really that you know, I'm hearing. And not that I'm like the DJ critic and, you know all about it, but I think I know a thing or two about it. And, I mean, there's nothing that blows me away. Have you guys heard any stuff like that where these guys have done that? And, it sure does make your job a lot easier, and you have, you know, much more access to your entire library instantly. You know, to me, it just seems like they've gotten to be a lot lazier, and, you know, they're not as creative, and, you know, they'd rather be talking to the chicks than keying in on, you know, mixing records and putting stuff together very creatively and cool, so that it's, you know, people enjoy it and, you know, give you the respect as being somebody that goes that extra distance to create intensity on the dance floor.
Well, I think that I can only speak for myself, but back when I was a DJing, I was a student of DJing. I was a student of the art. I really felt like it was a whole different way of expressing yourself musically. I mean, I like Steve, I tried to play drums. I wasn't very good. You know, I tried to sing, forget it, you know. So, but DJing gave me an outlet to express myself musically. So I used to go to, like, in L.A., go listen to all the great DJs. That, you know, I would ask, who are the best DJs in town? Then I would go listen to them. When I would go to New York every year, I would make sure I would go listen to all the top DJs and study them, listen to them, buy records, and practice and practice and practice. And like I said earlier, when we first started spinning, trying to match two different drummers was not that easy. You can match it for a little bit, but the BPMs fluctuated quite a bit, so you had to think of creative ways to mix. Then the records started to get synthesized, and you had, you know, records like My Forbidden Lover coming out in the early 80s, and you had Danger, and you had a lot of dance records that were using drum machines, and they were easier to mix. So I kind of come from a school of...
Before you go, like, you know, when there was a live drummer playing drums, they tend to speed up and slow down.
Oh, yeah.
To you know what I mean? To keep, like, a soulful feel to the quarter note kick drum and the hi-hats doing the same thing over and over and over. They try to put a little bit of soul to it. So when they started putting drum machines in it, it's, like, dead on straight. I mean, you can overlay records 3-4 minutes long, you know what I mean? So that, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay, but it's like Love Insurance. You guys familiar with that song, Love Insurance? A great classic disco record. It's not easy to mix. The break jumps from 131 beats per minute to 137, just on the break, and then it slows back down. So that's what, you know, that's what we're talking about. So for me, it seemed like when techno came in that the music really, really changed. And that I started to see where the DJs weren't into really mixing or being creative with their mixes, because the drum machines, all you have to do is find two records with the exact same BPM and they were a lot easier to mix. So I saw a lot more segueing from one song to the other. Yeah, it was on beat. Yeah, the energy remained the same, but in terms of being like a creative mixer, and maybe we were forced to be creative back in those days because of the way the records were produced. So I do see kind of that, and I don't know if DJs, the young DJs coming up, are going out to go hear Joseph Christopher or Joe Casillas or any of the veteran DJs that are, or Adrian, or any of the veteran DJs that are in this room. I don't know. You know, my son went to a rave this past week, and or a couple of weeks ago, and he was like blown away at the music. But I'm not sure if he knows what they were doing or the way they were mixing. I've heard all the top DJs, even the current ones, and since you don't know the songs and it's all very progressive,
they're all like dubs.
They're all instrumentals. When they're mixing and when they're not mixing, you know. So maybe there has been a little bit lost in the transition.
Yeah, right.
I've been to New York and I've heard like all the DJs and that were from our era. And for me, it's like the love of the sport. You know, you have a lot of tools to work with. There's a lot of different ways to go about doing any mix. Like the guys in New York, they were messing with the crossovers and just for effect. So as long as you're giving your crowd an effect, a mix, a jump, a jolt, you know, you're creating energy and you're creating excitement for your room. Maybe the DJs, I haven't gone out much, but maybe the DJs nowadays are just more complacent with just playing record to record, you know, without. But there's a lot of tools and a lot of ways and a lot of means with your equipment to do exciting stuff. Maybe they're just not using it.
Right, sure. Well, you know, it's funny that you guys mentioned, you know, the new music seminar that all of us would go, and we'd all hang out together. And I remember the 1 year that, I'm not sure if Carlos went out, I know you and I went, and Jelly Bean Benitez was the hot producer at the time.
He was at Area.
I'm getting there. You were there?
I was there.
Okay, so we all went. You know, we go there, and you know, they're playing, you know, the typical music, commercial dance stuff, and we started hearing this music that sounded so much like disco, only funkier, which I know Peebo and I brought it back, which wound up by being house music.
Right.
And it was
Marshall Jefferson.
Marshall Jefferson, Love Can't Turn Around by Farley, Jack Master Funk.
Still turning.
Jack Your Body.
Right.
Adonis, No Way Back. And you know,
Move Your Body.
We were in this place, and we were partying, you know, I'm not going to lie about it, but, you know, we were there, and we heard this music, and, you know, we're going, what is this sound, man? We got to get these records and bring them back, and we started playing them here, and, you know, all of us that got them, I think it was only you and I that brought them back.
Right.
And we turned on, like, Frank and Henry and, you know, Carlos had some
record stores and bought them.
Yeah, and they finally got out here, and it started being added in these clubs, and it took off from there. You know, the European people got a hold of it, and you know, they took it to another level, and they continue to take it to another level. Just 2 weeks ago, I was at Danny Z's birthday party, and there's some house music that's coming out it is just unbelievable, and it just continues to get better and better and better and better.
Yeah, there was like one time we were in New York. There was a big Latin club called 1018 where they used to play freestyle music. And that night, Noel was going to make his world debut singing Silent Morning. And little I admired about the East Coast that didn't happen here on the West Coast was that they love their DJs. The respect. And so while the song is playing, right, Show Me, Cover Girls, and he's doing mixing back and forth. He's like tearing it up, and all of a sudden the crowd starts going, Little Louie, Little Louie. And all of a sudden you've got 3,000 young Puerto Ricans and Latinos
you gotta mention chanting. The 1018 club was probably 3,000 capacity.
Right.
Big giant
monster club
with a ceiling. I mean, a huge club, and these people are doing that.
Right, right. They just had a lot of respect that
the DJs.
We
got
come
so
back.
Much respect.
We would come back from New York. We get excited, and then our clubs were like, "Eh,
yeah.
hey, people, what's up?"
Okay, you know what? Something I thought about doing here was, you know, putting you guys in a mind frame. You know, it's August 6th, and it's 1979. Mm. You know, describe, you know, a night at your club. You're it's Saturday night, and it's, you know, August 6, 1979. What are you doing, Carlos? What's happening there?
It's a lot of cocaine.
I was waiting for that.
No, it was just a lot of fun, a lot of free sex. You know, it was easy to get laid.
And that's fucking what's A, huh?
That's what's up.
You know, that's what was happening.
Well, I don't know if I can.
How can you top that?
I can't top it, but I'll just maybe describe, you know. Hey, you know, it was like, it was a lot of fun. It really was a lot of fun. Knowing that your club was going to be packed, knowing that you were going to have a great time. I would just, I would get to the club early. I would smoke a couple of cigarettes and kind of get in the mood, start playing just familiar music, but you don't really want to play dance music yet because you want to just soften up the crowd, so to speak. And, you know, my target was like 9:30, 10 o'clock to pack the floor, and I wouldn't have my first drink until after I had the floor packed. And then I, you know, have a drink so I could relax a little bit. And then it was like, since I was at the Fantasias a lot, it was like, and I worked till 4, I took them on trips, different trips. And I started like 100 beats per minute. And I'd graduate all the way up to 160 or 70, do a new wave set, do something that ended cold, and boom, brought them down. One slow song, and then you start back up again. So you try to peak them at midnight. You peak them at midnight, you bring them back down, and then you start them up all over again, and then you do another set where you would peak them at 125 to 130, because at 130, you made, you know, you said last call for alcohol, and then you play slow songs until 145. Yeah. And then after that, then you start up all over again, then you play till 4.
Yeah, the late night set.
Yeah. So that's kind of like the way the evening went. And I had like this formula, and I thought I'd share it with you guys, is that I would write down every song I played every night. So after a while, I can figure out, so that way I wouldn't play the same songs, you know, so I could change my repertoire.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to cut you off, but, okay. I started working with George Tong. Remember George Tong?
Yeah, he was a great light man.
He started being a manager over there. And you know, he wanted me to be his DJ, and I was playing his night, and he told me, he actually forced me to do that. And I talked to somebody about that recently, and he'd be like, Steve, you know, you want to write down? And I'm going, every record? He's like, every record. Yeah, I'm going, it's probably like 50 records a night. How can I, you know? Well, that way you can see, you know, you can see where your weak spots were. You know what I mean? You were taking it, and the way he would describe it is, you know, you're on this train going on a track.
Right.
And you know, you can see pretty much where, you know, when I played that, it kind of screwed up the floor. Or, you know, maybe, you know, you could have taken another slot off and then come back around eliminating these tunes. And it was, you know, I got to tell you, working at Fantasia was, you know, was very, very educational because, you know, the DJ booth was right on the floor. I mean, you know, you have people dancing right here. And, you know, they're coming up, and you know, just to tell you a quick story, I'll never forget this one. Martin Rodriguez, and you know many stories about them. Yeah, he's spinning in this spaceship DJ booth, and you guys can tell him I said this story. But, you know, this girl's on the floor, and they had a little window there, and he's standing there, and the window's open, and this girl comes up, and she's dancing. Hey, you know, can you play Shannon Give Me Tonight? And he's, you know, ignoring her, right? You know, excuse me. And she starts waving her hands in his face. And she's standing there. He does his mix and looks at her and goes, fuck you. And walks away. Oh, man. So funny. But, I mean, that like I said, that was... I mean, for myself, that was a huge education
right.
In that particular room.
Right.
Were you done?
No.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just had to throw that in.
Well, he kind of hit on it. When you have, like, at the end of the night and you look at all the songs that you played and then you start to count them, you figure you're playing 60 to about 80 songs a night. And then you can take a look at that list, and each song, you could relive it in your mind, how the mix went and how the night went. And like you said, you could just scratch out things that didn't work, and after a while, you could really...
You have a monster set.
And each night, and of course, you have to change it up, but...
You know, I'll tell you guys about Florentine Gardens. I mean, that was probably the first club. Other than that, you know, the earlier stuff was doing the Casa with Caesar and Tony, which, you know, was always fun. I mean, they, you know, tons of people showed up. Florentine Gardens, you know, we did freestyle and we did K-Rock, and it was, you know, Tony, like I said, Tony was a star, did everything there. People just went crazy. Everybody was there. It was the hot spot to be. You know, the radio jocks were there. We did, you know, K-Rock state spots. Everything was happening. Nothing comes to mind. But, you know, what I wanted to ask Carlos and Peebo was, you know, during that time, I mean, you know, DJs go through records left and right. You know what I mean? Something's hot 1 minute. When it dies out, you pull out your another record and add something in there. You know, in your crate of records, which, you know, I'll understand if you guys can't, you know, come and pinpoint. But, you know, like, what records did you keep in rotation in your set the longest?
Atomic Dog. Yeah. Not because I liked it, because I had to, you know. That was probably the one record that...
No, I said three.
But that one stands out. I mean, if you needed to pack the floor, or, you know, I mean, Atomic Dog probably came out in like 82, 83, or something like that. Man, it was 1990, and they're still requesting that damn record.
Well, they still request it.
So you had to have it.
I would say for me, Mandalay, Capital Tropical, and Love Is In You. Those three. You're going to play them forever. There's something about those three records, for sure. I mean, My Forbidden Lover, too, but it seems like Mandalay, and especially Capital Tropical.
Yeah, like the Lime Records, or what else? Machine There Before the Grace of God. That was one of mine. I really, really love that song.
Super Freak.
Super Freak, yeah.
Yeah, Give It to Me, Baby.
And then you know, I mean... There was really, you know, back then, you know, how you guys mentioned Chris the Glove Taylor and what have you. You know, back then, you know, who did you guys listen to that would do overlays and mixes? You know, who was it? Did you guys just, you know, figure it out? Or was there somebody that you would go like, wow, you know, this guy can put records together. Cool, you know what I mean? I want to try and do that. Or you just developed your own style.
Well, I started, like I said, in Puerto Rico, and there was a guy there at a gay club. The club was called Bachelors, and I had already asked around. They said he was the number one DJ in all of the Caribbean. So I would go listen to him, and he would do these mean overlays. So then at my club, there was two of us, so on my break, I would run down to Bachelors, listen to him mix, and then I would go back to my club and try him. Of course, they never came out as good as his, but, I mean, that was one guy. Then the guy Mike Lewis.
Yeah, it's a circus.
Mike Lewis, he ended up being the DJ at Studio One. It's a gay club in West Hollywood. I don't know if it's still there. Mario Gonzalez, who was a very good DJ. But when it came to overlaying, I would have to say that Martin Rodriguez was the man. Henry Valdez came and said, hey, you know what, they got this new young guy named Martin Rodriguez, you got to go hear him. And so I said, well, let's go. So of course we went, and then Martin, he had this style that reminded me of the DJs in Puerto Rico, but with different records, of course. And so listening to Martin made me go back and really try to polish up my style because I saw that how effective his style was with that big crowd.
He was like surgical.
Yeah.
Carlos.
About that, I would have to say Martin Rodriguez.